Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts from 970 ESPN and Steelers Nation Radio, David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves chilling, talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. Season 7, episode 126. I'm Dave Bryan from SteelersDepot.com. And sitting in with me on this Friday for David Todd once again is Alex Kozora. Alex, happy Friday. 2 weeks from today, you will be probably about this same time heading to or right at La Trobe at this point, because Steelers report to training camp 2 weeks from yesterday. Their first official practice of 2017 will be 2 weeks from today. I can see the end. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not a train, I don't think.
I think, based off what you've been telling people, Dave, the light at the end of the tunnel is just a bunch of McChickens. Are you trying to kill me? You're telling everybody to send me McChickens. I can't handle it.
Absolutely. I figure you could eat the McChickens and then sign the wrapper. Being you're so famous, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be wanting your autograph there when they get to St. Vincent College out there. No, just giving you a hard time there. Bloggers don't eat the best generally anyway.
I'm going to die before I can sign the autograph. Keel over.
But I mean, look, exciting time right now. I mean, look, I think we can both admit the traffic on Steelers Depot has been picking up the last week. So a little bit more activity on Twitter as well, too. I think people are starting to feel that training camp is right around the corner. And I think the best thing about most of this offseason is that they're really – in the grand scheme of things, hasn't been a lot of drama, especially when it comes to the Steelers specifically and the amount of drama. Yeah, we had the whole Ben Roethlisberger may or may not retire earlier in the offseason, a few other minor things, but nothing like what it's been, maybe compared to in past seasons, maybe at least not even, the last five or so. However, there was a report late Thursday night by Dan Graziano of ESPN concerning some things that Martavis Bryant reportedly said. And Martavis reportedly is out in my neck of the woods again, out in Henderson, Nevada, which is right down the street from Las Vegas, Nevada. And why don't you kind of recap what Martavis said about some of the things that Roethlisberger has said about him over the course of the last year?
Yeah, he told Dan Graziano of ESPN. I'll just read the one quote here because I want to make sure it's accurate. Brian says about Ben, quote, "We should have a man-to-man because some of the things he put out there about me, I kind of didn't agree with how he did it. So I want to sit down and hear his own opinion, man-to-man, about why he did that." I don't think he specifically said it in the article, but we assume this comes from a lot of comments that Roethlisberger made last year about feeling lied to and disappointed and a sense of betrayal from what Bryant had told Ben, before the suspension and maybe afterwards. So that's kind of the gist of the comments, Dave.
Yeah, and look, Martavis has been through a lot over the course of the last year and all, and he appears to be on the straight and narrow right now. I don't know if he's feeling a little bit more confident now, his comeback, if you will. Maybe that's causing him to speak a little bit more. I don't know. But look, Ben has always been Ben. Ben has learned a long time ago how to get messages across to certain players through the media. He's become, and he doesn't run from it, until maybe 2 days after, and then he'll say, "Well, what I meant to say is this." He always has a good way of kind of covering his tracks, if you will, while still getting his message across. Now, my thought now, could Ben have handled some of the things that he said in the past about Martavis better? Should he have said some of the things that he said? Context can always probably be better. Ben's always been blunt, as I've said. However, if Martavis had a problem with any of that, this past offseason here during the, during the OTA and mandatory minicamp practices, you could bet that if I were him, I would have marched right on up to Ben and said, "Hey, let's go get a let's go to the cafeteria. Let's go let's go sit down in the bleachers or something like that and hammer this thing out." And that obviously didn't happen. How Graziano was able to get to Bryant and get him to comment on such matters, I don't know. I think Martavis would have been better served just let things lie there. But here we are now, 2 weeks ahead of training camp, and you can bet now when both Ben and Martavis report to training camp, this will be one of the things that the two of them will be asked about immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple thoughts here. You know, I Ben and Bryant have been talking for, at least 6 months, because back in January, Roethlisberger said that either Bryant had reached out or Ben reached out to him. I forget how it started, and they had started talking. And you think if this is something that's been eating away at Bryant, you know, it would have come up either then, throughout the offseason, at OTAs, you know, something that would have come up. So I'm not sure why now all of a sudden before camp and once the focus becomes on football in the season that it's got to be a topic to discuss. Ultimately, I think this stuff will blow over. I don't want to sit here and, you know, clutch my pearls and say this is the worst thing in the world. But I will say this for Bryant, this comes with the territory, man. You screwed up, and you screwed up in a big way, and you let down your teammates in one of the most major ways possible. So you're going to have to take your lumps and deal with some of this stuff that, yeah, I'm sure you don't like to hear, but you probably need to hear because of the actions that you did and the way that you screwed up before. And we all hope that Bryant has changed his life, and to his credit, he's taking a lot of steps right now, at least, that appears to indicate that. But that comes with the territory, man. When you screw up like that, you know, people are going to criticize you. And Ben's always been very open and vocal about challenging Bryant, both when he was with the team and during his suspension. So he's got to man up and take it.
Now, you know, we talk about Ben and Martavis, quote-unquote, maybe talking over the course of the last year or what have you. You know, to me, texts don't really count, you know, because I just can't see Roethlisberger typing out a diatribe, you know, on his phone or whatnot, and definitely can't see him sitting down and typing an email. And on the flip side, I can't see Martavis Bryant, three paragraphs in direct messages either type of thing. On the flip side, I obviously can't see Martavis calling Ben and saying, "Hey Ben, you got about an hour to sit down and chat here." Ben said, "Yeah, I'll just have my wife corral these three kids up and let me go to my study and we'll talk here for the next hour and a half." Yeah, I can't envision it going that way. You know, as much as time as these players spend with each other during this season, and how, you know, look, I mean, we've heard Vince Williams and Ryan, you know, say him and Ryan Shazier are very close and spend a lot of time maybe off the field. And I'm sure there's a lot of players on teams that are maybe buddy-buddy off the field. But I just can't see Roethlisberger being buddy-buddy with many folks off of the field right now. A, the age gap, he just doesn't have that much in common, with players maybe other than Debo, and Debo's busy getting needles poked in his back and lifting 3,000 pounds, you know, that kind of thing. So I guess where I'm going with this is still is the fact that Martavis should have maybe found a way to track Ben down recently. Maybe he did. Maybe Ben said, "Look, we'll get to you. I got to go do this. I got to go do that." You know, maybe they just haven't had time to sit down and talk. I think they will, obviously, now. You know, once they report to training camp and you get in them dorms and you can't run away from it, perhaps they'll sit down for 30 minutes or what have you. In the grand scheme of things, I don't think this is a big deal whatsoever. The thing is, as I mentioned, you can bet both Ben and Martavis will be asked about it that probably that first Thursday when they get to training camp. And then, you know, we'll have to write about it. We'll have to talk about it again and then put it behind them. I don't see this as a big deal. I just, you know, part of me, if nothing positive can come out of it, my motto always is don't even talk about it. And especially someone like Martavis, who really – he hasn't proven he's back yet. I mean, we all think and hope it's going to go in that direction. I've written several times, boy, if there's one candidate for comeback player of the year in 2017, it's Martavis Bryant. What a great story it would be if he goes out and catches, you know, 65 balls, 1,200 yards, 10 touchdowns, Steelers win Super Bowl, Martavis Bryant's MVP. I mean, you couldn't write a better Hollywood script after all he's been through. But the fact of the matter is, yeah, all that's happened right now is he's been conditionally reinstated and nothing more. So until that's removed, that interim tag is kind of removed, just keep your damn mouth shut. You know, don't talk to anybody. Stay off Twitter. You know, just go out to Las Vegas and get your work in and show up at training camp and show people that you mean business.
Yeah, I agree that it's not a big deal, and we will talk about it for a couple days once camp starts, and then it will blow over once we have actual football to discuss. But, you know, I think they had plenty of time to hash this out. You know, even if it is during the offseason, and Ben can take a half-hour phone call, I think, from Brian, or they can talk after practice, before practice, meetings. I mean, they got plenty of opportunities if it was really that big of a deal as Brian seems to be making it out to be. Now, to be fair, you know, in Graziano's article, Brian goes on to say that he loves Ben, he's a brother. You know, I don't think there's super hard feelings there. I think there's just a Brian wanting some sort of clarification and to come to an understanding. But yeah, probably not the time or place to tell people about this. You know, we're getting to training camp, and once training camp starts, focuses on football, focuses on coming together as a team, winning the Super Bowl, and doing the steps necessary to achieve that. Not this, off the field kind of talk that's just going to serve as a distraction.
Yeah, it's become he said, she said, and you know that's the kind of stuff that look, you know, I've always said though that I wish players would be a little bit more candid, you know, especially after games. You know, who blew the coverage there? Well, we all blew the coverage. Oh, you know? Yeah. No, you didn't. Who blew the coverage? Mm-hmm. You know, tell us. You know, and we know obviously why that doesn't happen. You don't want, you know, finger pointing and all like that, but you know, if it can be constructive at times and you know, those kind of things. I've always thought players should be a little bit more honest when it comes to media, but I understand why they're not on top of it. And once again, I don't think this is a big problem, but I there's going to be pushback from the other side, people protecting, fans protecting Martavis, saying, oh, well, Ben must forget what it's like. You know, Ben was way too hard on Martavis through the media. Doesn't Ben remember what he put this team through several years ago, and yada yada. So, you know, you're gonna, like it or not, you're gonna have a division in the fan base over a topic like this, just as you do any topic for the most part. And you know, it's just the kind of thing. Look, you can probably get clicks on the site for us on Friday and maybe Saturday. And of course, you know, we've now eaten up about 20 minutes of this podcast talking about it. But you know, come the first few days of Latrobe, hopefully all this will be behind us, and it should be. And I don't expect to have any issue with one another, you know, getting on into the season.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more, Dave.
Okay, today is Friday. That means we're going to have potentially one more show before we find out what ultimately is going to happen or has happened or hasn't happened with running back Le'Veon Bell. Monday, of course, 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern time is the deadline for the Steelers to sign Le'Veon Bell to a long-term contract extension. People asking me, probably asking you, probably asking others, what the heck's going on with negotiations? Does anybody know? Are they even talking? Look, I mean, everybody listening to this podcast knows about as much as I do is when it comes to that. There hasn't been any reports that I've seen about, you know, negotiations not going well, or the Steelers have this final offer out there or that final offer. You know, we just got a few days left, and we're going to have to wait. Now, you know, we have talked quite a bit about. In fact, I wrote a long, long post this past week talking about, you know, Roethlisberger and how, you know, what Joe Corey, who I've had on the show several times, had to say about possibility of a deal getting done. And Corey, who was on NBC Sports Radio with Mark Malone at that, said it's a hard deal to do. He explained why. I kind of – look, I think I spelled this out very well in the post as well, Alex. I love all deals to get done, you know, because it, you know, I love math that does not include letters of the alphabet in it. You know, I was, believe it or not, Alex, I was good at math from probably about 4 years old up until hitting high school. But once algebra came along,
I was similar.
That was it. Boy, I could do my multiplication tables. I could do division. I could do addition, subtraction, all that kind of stuff. But once you started throwing X and Z and Y out there, and they weren't football terms, positions on the field, that lost me. But to this day, you know, I think everybody knows that I love looking at contracts. I love speculating about contracts. I love following the salary cap and everything that goes along with it. So I'm always an optimistic guy, I think, when it comes to deals potentially getting done, because I want them to get done. I want to look at the numbers. You know, I have said in previous podcasts, talked about, and I still think the numbers hold true, that if a deal gets done, I think it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of you know 10 to 10 and a half to 12 million average yearly value, 18 million to maybe 20 million in first year take home money. But from then it gets a little bit dicey, and I think I laid it all out, you know, versus the franchise tag over the next 2 years and what Bell probably wants over the next 2 years versus what the Steelers might, you know, let's face it, Steelers guarantees are normally for non-quarterbacks just a signing bonus, everything that goes along with it. And you look at Woodley's contract a few years ago. He was given a $13 million signing bonus, and he was paid $27 million over the first 2 years. I guess you could say, after doing some searching and listening a little bit more and all, I'm a little less optimistic about a deal getting done for Bell by Monday. But I'm still not a slam dunk. It's not going to get done. There's a lot of good reasons for Bell to get the deal done, particularly for the position that he plays and his injury history in the past. So we'll see. So instead of spending more time on that, let's talk a little bit about what happens if a deal doesn't get done. And I think the first thing that people go to is the fact that wondering that if a deal doesn't get done by July 17th at 4 p.m. is, will Bell hold out for training camp? And look, until he signs that tag, it is his right. I mean, he's not part of the team. He's not any more part of the team than you or I am, Alex. You know, not under contract doesn't mean you need to report to anything. However, it would really behoove him to sign the contract and get his butt to camp on time, because it's not like him sitting out camp is going to create a long-term deal, because the Steelers' hands will be tied. They just simply can't sign him at that point. You know, some will argue, well, he might not want to get injured, maybe wanting to make a point to next year. Nothing good, in my opinion, comes out of Bell not signing the tag and not reporting to training camp on time.
It would be the dumbest thing for him to do, and I think it's the dumbest thing for people to suggest, because there's no good reason for it. We know the Steelers organization does not appreciate people holding out. Even Hines Ward years ago, you know, they weren't going to do a deal with him until he came back to camp. You know, that was the understanding there. There's no benefit. As you pointed out, you can't do a long-term deal after July 17th if it doesn't get done. You got to wait till the, you know, end of next, to the start of the offseason, starting next year. So you can't get that done. And, you know, the other comment is, well, you don't want to go through the rigors of training camp. Bell had, in the 11 non-joint practices last year, Bell had 29 carries. And that's not much of the rigors of camp. And coming off the injury this year and wanting to limit him, knowing he's going to be available for all 16 games, you could limit him for probably, you know, almost the entire camp. You know, I sit him out the first 2 weeks, practice him the third week, play him in the third preseason game for a quarter, and then shut him down for week one against Cleveland. So you can get through camp with him getting 15 carries and hardly taking a hit. You know, Bell's practices and his training is probably going to be more intense than what he'll go through in training camp. So I think it's just the worst argument all around. And there is no benefit and only downside for Bell to even think about holding out for camp. It would just be reckless and selfish, and I don't think Bell's going to do that.
And look, I mean, there's a good chance anyway, you know, with the off-season groin surgery, that he starts off training camp on active PUP, mm-hmm. just as right. precaution, because Kevin Colbert, dating all the way back, I think, to the week before the NFL combine, said in so many words that they're not going to push Le'Veon Bell at all. They want to make sure he's 100% healthy come the start of the season. And, I mean, look, you know what you have in him. There's no reason to work him much, if any, during training camp. You want to get him hit once or twice during maybe two preseason games, and that's it. You know, possibly the third preseason game, you know, three carries, maybe the final one, you get him out there to run or ladder him up and get him hit one time, and then you pull him out, and all is said and done. So, you know, there's absolutely nothing to gain by Bell, for, you know, not only not showing up for training camp, but not signing his tag, because not that I think it's going to happen or there's a chance of it happening, but if we don't mention it and it happens, and people are going to say, well, you didn't mention it was going to happen. I don't think the Steelers would ever consider ripping the tag away from them the way that the Carolina Panthers did with Josh Norman. That obviously happened much earlier in the offseason. However, if you don't sign the tag, there's always the possibility, you know, let's say you got 3 weeks out, you know, from the start of the regular season, you haven't been in training camp, you know, you still haven't signed your tag. The Steelers could say, you know, that at that point they probably, you know, their patience would be tried. Let's say they said to heck with you, pulled the tag out from underneath them. Would Bell find himself $12 million in 2017 at that point?
Probably not, but I think we're getting way down the rabbit hole here, Dave. I know we're just, you know, entertaining possibilities, but I don't think it's ever going to come close to that.
Right, but why would you even risk that, you know?
Yeah,
Is where I'm going with it. No, I don't think it's going to happen at all, and I think it has as much chance as happening as Bell, you know, not reporting to training camp. But, you know, we'll see. Until he signs that tender, he's not under contract. Mm-hmm. But that's really the only thing. And then, yeah, we can start speculating from there whether or not the Steelers would franchise him, you know, place a franchise tag on him next year, yada, yada. But, you know, in order for that to happen, he would have to have a solid 2017 season. And I got to wondering yesterday, and I got to wondering, oh, it ended up being a wondering process. It took me like 4.5 to 5 hours, and my data research was flawed to begin with, and then I had to correct it. It was flawed again, had to correct it again, had to rewrite the post, and then here I am five hours later with the research that I think reveals a lot of facts, but I don't think drew any hard conclusions. And I kind of went into this, as I do a lot of these stat studies, just kind of being curious for myself. And then I say, well, I'm going to go ahead and share the data along the way here. And I'm not sure what you got out of it, Alex, but my initial study was to take a look at 25-year-old running backs and how they performed following 300 touch seasons since 2000. And since 2000, and including last year, Le'Veon Bell became the 25th running back to have 300 or more touches during a season. Bell, in fact, had 336. And I think the most astounding fact about that is he had all those touches in a span of 12 regular season games. But I think if you look back at since 2000, the other 24 running backs who have had 300 or more touches in a season, and how they have, you know, done statistically and statistically only, the following season after those 300 touches, there's not a lot to be excited about, I don't think, overall.
Yeah, but, you know, I think there's value to it, Dave, and obviously a ton of hard work going into that one, so kudos to you for that. But, you know, I think you made the point in the article, and you said the history is the history, and you know, is there a causation in that correlation? And it's a little tougher for me to try to find that in all the data.
I think the biggest takeaway still is the fact that a lot of these running backs on this list missed at least two or more games the following season. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest takeaway. And I think especially when you look at a guy like Bell, who has had problems staying healthy. You throw out the suspended games. I mean, he has missed, you know, a few games, especially, you know, including the postseason due to injuries. And then, of course, he is now coming off of a groin injury. And I think when you look at overall, you know, rushing yards being down and total yards from scrimmage being down and averages for the most part being down, I think there is a little bit of cause to be concerned there. And when you look at the backs who actually have seen increases, you know, guys like Edgerrin James, Deuce McAllister, and Ricky Williams saw an increase in total rushing yards this season immediately following their 300 plus touch seasons at the age of 24. People don't forget that this study is done on running backs at the age of 24 and 24 only. And, you know, that's why you have such a small sample size of only really 24 backs, what we're dealing with there. That James, Deuce McAllister, Forte, and Williams, really three of those four, James and McAllister and Ricky Williams, were kind of differently put together running backs, right?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Now Forte is much more in the build of you know, and a line of Bell, right?
Yes, yeah, pretty similar.
So you know, could it be that you know those better put together? I don't want to say better put together backs. You get where I'm coming at. The more physically imposing looking backs, if you will, kind of guys, you know, have been the only ones that have saw an increase in total rushing yards outside of guys like Forte. Now, the thing about, and I thought this was another interesting aspect, and maybe I didn't highlight it enough, is the fact that the amount of prior total touches that these running backs have had entering the season, you know, entering the season where they had their 300 plus touch season at the age of 24. You look at a guy like Deuce McAllister, he didn't have anywhere on him. He had 31 total touches at the entering his season at the age of 24 when he went on to touch the football a whopping 352 times. And then, of course, he followed that up with a decent season, but only, you know, and came out of that season with 403 total touches. Now, on the flip side, you could point to a guy like Edgerrin James, you know, who entered his 2002 season at the age of 24 with over 1,000 total touches, and that's where Le'Veon Bell is at right now, is over 1,000 touches. So, now, is it just, you know, is there not enough data here to draw any hard conclusions? You know, is the age versus the mileage on each one of these back being different? Is the offense, is the quarterback, is, you know, are there just too many variables here? What direction would you, did I not scratch the surface on that you think this needs to be drilled down deeper into?
No, I think you did it as thorough as you can. I mean, there's only so many variables you can control and be able to quantify. My only other thought, really, Dave, is that, you know, when I think about a workload for a running back and think about a decrease in the next year, it's usually around that 300 carry mark. You know, I remember when I was an avid fantasy football player, it was always watch out for those 300 carry guys that usually decline. And the good thing with Bell is while he has a ton of touches, a lot of those come from receptions, which generally are going to have a little less wear and tear or less hits you're going to take than carries. You know, only had 261 last year. And I think if you look at some of the backs that had as many.
On probably 90% of your catches, you're still going to get tight. You're still going to get hit.
Yeah, but not by multiple guys. You're not in spaces. You have a sideline to your advantage. It's less of a hit that you're taking, generally speaking, on a reception than on a run play, right? You're not getting 350-pound nose tackle on top of you.
I don't know. Bell don't make it far past down the field.
But, I mean, I look at Ray Rice was one of the guys that had a lot of receptions. He didn't have a drop-off the next year. Tomlinson did, but he had a big workload. So Forte, Forte had a good amount of receptions. He didn't have the drop-off. So, you know, I'm just saying, you know, I think touches, when you look at Bell with the receptions, I think that changes the equation a little bit.
So you think just the type of touches mean more? In other words, more rushes, the more you get concerned.
Sure. I mean, imagine if Bell had, and he had 261 carries last year, 75 catches. Imagine if he had 350 carries last year and 25 catches. I'd be more concerned about that workload than I would be what he had, wouldn't you?
Well, you know, the magic 300 carry number has always been out there for a while. I think people have done studies on that back with, what, Priest Holmes and Larry Johnson and those kind of guys. But 320, 340 touches is a lot of damn touches, man. And
right, but I'm just saying, if those were the bulk of that was carries, wouldn't you be more concerned than the split that he has right now?
Yeah. But, I mean, and look, anybody can counter this and say any player in the NFL is one hit away from having their career ended, and I get all that. Let me ask you this. Even though Bell put up the numbers that he did in 12 games last season, which I think is another thing that needs to kind of be taken into consideration when maybe projecting what he may or may not do in 2017, because let's face it, he could still have no problem just barely eclipsing those numbers as long as he plays in 15, 16 games for obvious reasons. But with that said, do you think his total touches will decrease from last year? And do you expect a decrease in average yards per carry and average yards per touch?
I don't think his average will really decrease, or you know, it wouldn't be anything significant. It might be 4.8 instead of 4.9, but you know, I think when you have Bryant and you have these deep threats and teams got to play a lot of too high to try to take away that's only going to help Bell. For the touches, I think it'll be about the same. I it's hard to put an exact number on it. It's going to be ebb and flow, but
you think it's over 300 though?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, he did that easily in 12 games last year, so yeah, easily.
Okay. Any chance at all, is 2,000 total yards out of the question?
What did he have last year? 1,884 I'm looking at here. I got his stats pulled up. I mean, he should be able to do it. What did you say total yards or rushing yards? I'm sorry.
Total yards from scrimmage, total, yeah.
Oh, he should be. I think he'll be able to do that. He did it in 2014. He was, what, 120 yards shy last year without four games on his resume? So, yeah, I mean, I think he can. I think he will.
I mean, interesting study nonetheless, I think, just because of curiosity to see how those backs did. But once again, as I mentioned at the top there, I'm not overly happy with the way it went. And I've kind of, being as how we're getting closer to the start of the of training camp, I got a hold of Daniel, who's written for us for quite a while now, who's probably a little bit better at compiling and going directions with stats. And he might drill down on that a little bit deeper there. All right, we had another kind of thing that happened since the last podcast, I think, worthy of discussion. And Ron Lippick got a hold of Robert Golden. And if Robert Golden had known that interview was going up on Steelers Depot, I wonder if he would have agreed to do it. But
hush, hush on all that.
Yeah. But with that said, I thought it was a very insightful interview that Ron did. I thought Golden revealed some stuff in there, and would you like to point out kind of the things that stuck out the most to you, what Golden had to say?
Yeah, I thought Golden was very candid about some of the scheme changes that have changed, and in that interview, maybe we can link it in the article too, for this week's podcast in case people missed it. There is some rah-rah stuff in there talking about how good the rookies are, and he ends it by saying this could be our year, we could go undefeated. You know, that's some stuff that he's supposed to say, and I'm glad that he is. You know, he's supposed to be the optimistic one, but you know, tune that out and focus on the specificity of what Golden talks about. He says Ron asks, how do you fix the slot issues? And Golden says, the short pass killed us last year. The slot is where teams beat us. We're taking away the inside and forcing teams to beat us from the outside. We played a lot of taller, faster receivers, and teams didn't really stretch the field against us. Now we're going to force them to try, make them go downfield. We have longer, lankier cornerbacks to cover those guys and can use those new guys to cover the slot guys better. We can bring the safety up or let the corners play the slot. This year we got the slot guys we need in the draft. So, you know, that is a, if that's true, a big change from the LeBeau and so far Keith Butler philosophy of, you know, force them to nickel and dime their way down the field.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've kind of talked in the past that you know, LeBeau's always been, don't get beat deep. You know, just don't give up the explosive play. Let them have everything underneath. Tackle to catch, and we'll live to fight another day as long as we don't get beat. Well, it's no longer a matter of, don't get me wrong, explosive plays go a big way in determining outcomes of ball games. However, I think that ends once you get in the playoffs, because you're going against better quarterbacks who have no issue, no problems whatsoever nickel and diming you down the field. So, yeah, you might not give up the 22 or 42-yard reception, but if they're able to connect at will and move the chains, what does it matter? You know, they can eat. They're more apt to eat the elephant one bite at a time instead of, you know, cutting it up into large pieces and almost choking on it. So I thought it was kind of insightful, and I am okay with the Steelers daring teams to beat them over the top more. And is it going to happen? Yes, it is. How will it balance out explosive play-wise? It might wind up being the same, to be quite honest with you. And the Steelers really as a whole have been good, I think, at not allowing passing explosive plays. However, I think it's going to give you a better opportunity to have a quarterback force a ball where it doesn't need to go, which in turn might create more opportunities for splash plays. We'll see underneath. And really, my biggest takeaway, I mean, outside of, you know, maybe some scheme things, which I think a lot of people are excited to potentially see during training camp, preseason, of course, regular season, is the fact that he said we can use those new guys to cover the slot guys better. This year we got the slot guys we need in the draft. Both guys are exceptional. Is he trying to tell us something there?
Yeah, I don't know. I got a question about that, what both guys meant. I mean, Cam Sutton, but he's not playing in the slot. I don't know who the other guy is. You could maybe try to infer that Brian Allen is going to be used there. Is that the direction you were heading in, Dave?
I don't know. I'm that's what I'm trying to say. What is he trying to tell? Could he just mean need in the draft, meaning maybe guys like Sutton, and then maybe inferring a guy like Cody Sensabaugh, who they got obviously during free agency and all like that. This year we got the slot guys we need in the draft. Well, technically, you only got one of them, you know, but potentially, because Brian Allen, I mean, look, Brian Allen, I mean, do you envision him at all doing much in the slot?
No, I think that would be putting him in a position he could not succeed in right away.
Right. So I'm not sure the direction, you know, that we're going there. And we've talked a lot about Sutton initially when he was drafted. I was thinking, okay, maybe this guy, you know, maybe some immediate potential as slot. And then we get into OTAs, and not that you can take a lot of what happens in that. Obviously didn't line up a lot there during OTAs. And now we'll see what your reporting has during training camp, you know, to see if he's given a chance. Or, you know, is a guy like Cinquez Golson just going to be given every opportunity whatsoever right from the get-go to sink or swim in the slot? I think he should. I think you really need to find out who Cinquez Golson is as long as he's healthy and can be on the field in the first couple of weeks of training camp when these pads are on. I want to know if it's time to cut bait or not.
No, I totally agree, and I'm sure Golson will be given that chance as probably the number two corner. My last thought on gold and the make teams beat you deep comment is, I'll have to see it and see how that looks. It's hard for me to really say if I agree with it or not right now, but I'll say this, Dave, is, if that's going to be the philosophy, is make teams go deep, these safeties better step up this year and really make some impact splash plays, Mike Mitchell and Sean Davis, because they're going to be playing a lot of catch points this year, and they're going to have to come up clutch to, whether it's cover two or two man where you're playing over the top, you're responsible for the deep ball. So, Mitchell and Davis, the onus is going to be on them to, take another step forward.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of real estate needing to be covered. And there's going to be instances where the safety just is going to have to get there, going back and watching. And look, I mean, even though we expect a lot of cover two, there's probably going to be some instances where we see some cover one out there with one deep. And who's that going to be 9 times out of 10? Mike Mitchell, probably, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right, and you go back, and I was going back watching some film on Justin Hunter during his time with the Bills, and one play in particular against forget who was against that they one of Hunter's touchdowns where more of a smash concept where, and then Hunter just runs to the corner and really only has the one deep safety having to cover them over the top, and that's a mismatch right there. So it is going to be a big onus, more so than probably we've ever seen in a while with Steelers safeties, to have to get the job done on some of these big plays. And I think you better get ready to allow some of them. Hopefully the trade-off in allowing a few more explosive plays is that you're getting some splash plays on the back end that are potentially leading to what I like to call putos, points off of turnovers.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just nerd out for 30 seconds here. And you said the smash route, and that's a great concept. It's one of the most common and popular ones to beat cover two, which the Steelers could still run a lot this year. Basically, where you have two receivers to a side, the number one outside receiver, number two slot. The number one outside receiver runs a curl route to bait the corner in to keep him close, and the number two slot receiver runs a corner route to the sideline. And, if he's got leverage on the safety, if the receiver's more to the outside than the safety, now the safety has to work over the top after recognizing the concept and get to the catch point. He's the only guy there that's going to have a chance if that corner is not sinking enough to squeeze the throw. So, you think about a very basic concept, one that every team runs, one that you're going to see a lot against defenses like Pittsburgh that'll run a lot of cover too. Safety's got to recognize, cover a lot of ground, not get out leverage, and then finish the play at the catch point. It sounds, it's difficult, obviously, and something that might sound kind of easy, but it's definitely tough in practice. You got to be perfect with it. So Mitchell and Davis, like I said, it's going to be all on them to solve some of those problems.
Mitchell, you don't so much worry about the recognition as much as you do now at his age, the ability to get there.
And Davis is kind of the opposite.
And Davis is kind of the opposite right now. Sometimes, deer in the headlights, I thought Davis, correct me if I'm wrong, because I mean, I and obviously I'm never wrong, but
Never.
Davis, I thought his intuition and his ability, his recognition was so much better the nearer the offensive line he was last year, and especially against the run.
I think that's very fair, and I tweeted a little bit, a couple clips of those out yesterday, 2 days ago. I think his recognition and zone coverage was solid, so I'm not saying that he was awful last year, but obviously as a younger player, still kind of learning his craft and dealing with injury last year, missing some time. That's going to be bigger of an issue than Mitchell, who's a veteran, has seen it all, and is gonna recognize it. But Davis did well in the box last year. Him as the single or the two deep shell had some more problems. I don't think he was terrible in coverage last year, but I think again the onus is going to be on him a lot more this year.
And that's where he needs to definitely pick it up. And look, I mean, make no mistake about it, Artie Burns. played, you know, he definitely came along. He made progress last year. Now, with that said, I think a lot of people are trying to prop Artie Burns up a little bit more than what he deserves. I mean, there were still some issues there with man coverage more than anything else. When you talk about pass defense with him, right? I mean, and we've heard Keith Butler talk about it, I think. We've heard Carnell Lake talk a little bit about it. Butler, in fact, I think even said like to see Artie be able to stay even with these guys a little bit more than he's been able to do. Now, the Steelers tried to run some trail and some man stuff last year, and for the most part, they ended up kind of scrapping that later on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, Dave. I was talking to a defensive coordinator buddy of mine today, and he was talking about Burns and kind of had some concern about him, about not flipping his hips in time and letting receivers eat up his cushion. And, you know, the old saying is if they're even, they're leaving. And that got Burns into trouble last year. Dallas against Dez beat him up pretty good, especially, you know, physicality and athleticism-wise, just not, you know, playing good technique to take advantage of the athleticism that Burns has. So, yeah, I mean, Burns did make strides last year. You know, that's pretty evident. But, yeah, he was the weak link, I think. And I think going into camp this year is going to still be the guy you want to look at and get a whole lot better because, you know, the Steelers played a lot of cover two last year, and a big reason for that was because that was kind of all Burns was comfortable playing, and they had to simplify the whole defense to tailor it to Burns because cover two is the easiest thing in the world for a corner to learn. So, you know, he's got to grow in a big way, and I hope and I'm optimistic that he can, but he's got to prove it.
So, in other words, you hate Artie Burns as much as I hate Ross Cockrell, right?
I'm sure that's what the people will take away from this after that.
look, the thing with Burns too, and I mean, we've talked. I think he'll get better against the run this year. I think he learned his lesson.
Yes,
last year. If he didn't by now, he's not going to get on some of those runs. He won't be poking that nose of his inside where you know, and try to do too much. And that's exactly what it ends up being. Mm-hmm. It's a player that tries to do too much and doesn't play within the scheme, and then, oh, there you go, 20 yards around the edge on your side because you're trying to do too much. I think Burns, or at least I hope and should, and the same goes for Sean Davis. As much as those two kids played in 2016, we should see some sort of jump in the right direction in 2017. Now, how big a jump, you know, we'll be left to determine. But we should not go into 2018 wondering, all right, can Burns or Davis make the jump? We should have a mm-hmm. good idea of what the NFL ceilings are on both these players after this year, yes or no?
They should and they will make a jump. I think it needs to be – I'll be stronger than that day. They need to make a big jump. I mean, I want to really see them grow in a significant way because unlike a lot of rookies in Steelers past, they got all this playtime year one. So you want them to be able to take and run with that and get a whole lot better in their first to second offseason. So not only do they just need to be for the sake and the health of this defense and the team, but for, yeah, their own personal long-term development and future – I expect them both to make a big jump. Burns, because he was so raw, and now he's kind of slowed everything down. And Davis, because obviously he was a rookie and being injured as well. Now that he's healthy, you want to see these guys get a whole lot better.
I guess that's where I'm going with this, was the fact that it shouldn't just be a tiny jump. It should be we should be wowing. I can't wait for 2018 to get here with these two guys. You know,
yeah, I mean, there should be fan club names for Burns and Davis. That's how good they need to play where people have fan clubs.
Now, with that said, you know, they don't have to be Pro Bowlers or anything like that. But I mean, they're definitely the splash plays should be up and it should be noticeable difference. I like to see the pass defense numbers go up and look, make no mistake. And we said it all along. If this pass rush. A lot of it's going to, you know, pass rush always makes secondary look better. So, you mm-hmm. know, if they can make their jumps, if the pass rush, you know, can be more consistent and aggressive, then all that's going to go together. It's going to make that back end of the defense look even better. Mitchell and Cockrell and whoever's mm-hmm. back there.
Right, and you said the key word there, and I'll apply that to the secondary of consistency. You know, that's where Burns and Davis have to be. And we talk about a big jump. Well, what does that mean? It's about consistency. Burns in coverage, communication, playing with good technique, his run fits have to be strong. And then Davis as a tackler, you know, I just broke him down, I think yesterday, in my One Step to Take series about him coming to balance, playing with good technique, near shoulder, near leg, you know, and being able to wrap and drive through and finish the play. That's the big bugaboo with them. They have talent. They've made splash plays in pockets. They've made impressive plays, but they have to show that consistency. That will get them to that jump in the next level.
Right, and look, I mean, statistically, and, you know, say what you will about that, I mean, I've proven or shown during the second half of last season where this defense did improve. I mean, tremendously. I mean, they got that adjusted Nets number yards against average down way lower than I thought they were going to be able to midway point of the season. However, however, that game against, I mean, it's all for naught if you go back and you look like crap, for a better better lack of a four-letter word, you know, against the games against New England. We see what this defense can do against marginal and slightly above average opponents during the second half of the season. Now what can you do against quarterbacks who, all right, you don't want to, you're not going to let me beat you deep. Okay, I'm not going to take my shots deep. I'm just going to continue to carve you up nickel and dime underneath. And that's the big thing with the Steelers defense moving forward.
Could not say it better myself, Dave. That is spot on.
All right. We're getting – boy, it's amazing how we're able to fill up some of this time here. And here we are with 10 minutes, I think, left in the podcast. We've been doing some positional breakdowns, so we probably should get into a position that's not gonna need a lot of talk. And that, I think, obviously, being as how we've been on the offensive side of the ball, is the quarterback position. Ben Roethlisberger, I mean – seems like we've talked about this just recently before. I mean, you'd like to see him play more consistent overall. Like to see him definitely play better on the road. The return of Martavis Bryant should definitely help. I don't, you know, with Bryant back, I don't think this team's going to miss the six games that Ladarius Green had. It'll be nice to get all these killer bees out there on the field at the same time, which is something that we really haven't seen since the Cincinnati game, middle of the season a couple years ago. I don't expect them to get sacked a lot. I don't expect them to take unnecessary chances. I think he'll be on the page a lot more with a lot of these younger guys, a la Eli Rogers. What else is there? I mean, we know who Ben Roethlisberger is and isn't at this point.
Yeah, you hit on it, Dave. I don't have a whole lot to add. I would just, you know, obviously I get better on the road. You know, I've talked about the possible issues with not running as much no huddle there, and that could be an issue. And, you know, run some more pistol this year. Ben struggled under center, you know, a little older, a little less mobile. Run some pistol. I don't know if it'll happen, but I'd like to see it. Mike Munchak has said he'd like to see it.
I'd like to see him maybe take a little, with Roethlisberger trying to, at times, trying to get 21 points back in one play, you know, and I'm kind of being, you know, sarcastic there, but we've seen some times where Roethlisberger has hurt himself, and I don't mean physically, I mean, you know, turnover or bad decision or whatnot, trying to get it all back in one play.
Right.
I'd like to see him maybe live to fight another day. Throw the ball out of bounds. You know, how many times have we seen Roethlisberger throw it away in the last three seasons?
Right.
You can count on one hand, right?
I could cut three fingers off and still have enough fingers to spare, I think. But I think why Bell's been a godsend for him, because it's given him a back that he has trust in to check it down to, someone that he knows can make plays with the ball in his hand. So I think that's been an underrated factor of Bell, obviously helping the whole offense in general, but giving Ben someone that he trusts, especially now post Heath Miller.
You know, he has the talent around him where, I mean, look, I know what happened against Philly last year and against Miami, and it always seems like there's one or two games a year where ho-hum, you know, 20 points down or what have you, or New England or what have you in the playoffs. The thing is, he has and should have the talent around him all season long that at no given point during the season should the offense be trailing by more than 10 points? So at any given point when you're down 10 or less, I mean, that's two possessions away from technically being in the league because it's, you know, two-point conversion, yada, yada, you know. And that's where I'm going with this, is you don't have to try to get all of it back in one series. The worst thing that you can do is turn the football over, give up another field goal, and then, oh, yeah, now you're two touchdowns behind in those situations. So I'd like to see him have a little bit more patience, even kind of later on in games where he doesn't try to make the big heroic play, and then you get a turnover, and then you're 13 points down, and then it's 5 minutes left, and then you know, oh man, we need two touchdowns now. Now there's no way it's going to happen now. So,
right.
Anything else you'd like to add on that Roethlisberger? Because obviously we know who he is at this point.
No, I think that's everything.
All right, Landry Jones, the guy that people, I think even yesterday on Twitter, somebody asked me, how much money do we save cap-wise if we're able to cut Landry Jones after the 2017 season? And the answer to that question, in case any of you are curious, is $1.9 million, and that is ahead of the 2018 season. And, oh, yeah, that's prior to roster displacement. So if you want to take a $500,000 salary that would replace him, yada, yada, you know, just over $1 million is what you potentially save on cutting Jones. Not this year, but next year. Jones is not going to be cut between now and the start of the regular season, regardless of if Joshua Dobbs throws six touchdowns, completes 80% of his passes, however ideal stat line you want to come up with during the preseason. Jones is going to be on this team in 2017, so we might as well talk about him.
And he'll be the number two. I don't really see any scenario, even if Dobbs plays well, that he's going to edge out Jones for the backup duty.
Footwork still needs overall mechanics needs to be increased or needs to still better vision, I think. Look, we saw when he came in that game, what was it, against the Dolphins last year, missed Xavier Grimmel going over the middle, right? On that third and one play, which, by the way, why the hell you calling a pass play on third and one or fourth and one or whatever it was when the three previous runs by Le'Veon Bell had averaged like 12 yards or something like that. Your quarterback comes into the game cold, and what do you want him to do? Throw a kind of a wheel route out to David Johnson. That not a good play call there. But Landry has his warts. The interception in the game against the Patriots was a huge, huge play. It killed a look, it's hard enough for this defense sometimes to force turnovers on their own end of the field, let alone get it in the opponent's end of the field, and against the New England Patriots at that. And just a poor decision. Overall decision making needs to be better. But, you know, there were some good things about Landry last year.
Sure. I mean, I think if you think about where he was his first, second year in the league and how bad he looked and how you and I and many others railed against Jones to cut him, keep two quarterbacks on the 53, to where Jones is at now as a competent, no, not great, but competent backup, it's impressive. His internal clock, I think, has probably made the difference for him, where he sped up the game, gotten the ball out of his hand a lot quicker, and taken a lot less sacks and being able to throw it open windows before things kind of tighten up. So that's been impressive. He's got a good arm, a very live arm. He's got great, I would even maybe say great deep ball accuracy. It's really good and really surprising, for maybe what I thought he was. His big issue for me, you know, it's some of the decision making, which you pointed out against the Patriots and other games, but that intermediate accuracy, throwing to a moving target, hitting the slant, hitting the 10-yard dig, that's not really been his thing. He really struggles with his accuracy on those throws. It's been a consistent problem throughout his entire career, even last season, as we've seen improvement from him. So that's what I want to see from Landry Jones, is that consistency and accuracy leading your receiver on those moving intermediate crossing routes.
And the ones across in between the numbers as well, too, right? He's more apt, I think, at times to go outside the numbers than inside.
Yeah, well, like I said, his accuracy outside deep ball, it's a lot better than it is on those intermediate crossing routes, the dig, the slants, you know, those kind of concepts. His accuracy really struggles. Ball placement, balls behind way too often, doesn't allow yak, doesn't always allow the catch.
And an average backup quarterback.
It's hard for me to quantify average. I don't watch every single backup quarterback. I'd maybe say a little above average, from the mentality that he has,
Well, you
his ability to prepare.
remember those rankings that we went over a couple weeks ago? We kind of contended, you know, five, six, seven quarterbacks maybe that we'd rather have over Landry. So,
Yeah, out of 32 teams, though, I think doesn't that constitute above average then?
yeah,
I think I have.
that's what I'm saying. We both kind of agreed that, you know, he definitely not the top of that list, and you know,
No.
an average. I would put him in the top quarter of all 30, you know, whatever, however the 32 backup quarterbacks align at the start of the 2017 season. I'd put him in the top, I don't know, seven, eight, top quarter, right?
Yeah, I think I had him like eighth off that list, and so he'd probably be around the top 10. So yeah, a little above average. He prepares well. He's, you know, whenever he comes in the game, he's going to be ready and has done his homework. Things that, you know, past backups haven't done, like a Mike Vick. So yeah, not the best, but you know, I'm relatively comfortable with Landry Jones.
Okay, and look, I mean, he can win you a game, maybe two, if you need him to. You don't want him playing eight games in a row, though.
It's like, who was that? Was that Harry Enns or Howard Mudd or Tom Moore? I think it was Tom Moore that said, you know, why don't you ever let the backup quarterback behind Peyton Manning practice? And I think Moore said something to the effect of, you know, we don't practice if we're, I'll say screwed. I'll keep it very PC here, because we're screwed if we lose Peyton. So yeah, any long-term issue with Ben's going to cause problems.
Absolutely. Okay,
I'll tell
Josh.
that story better some other time. I didn't tell it well, but
I don't
boy,
know.
funny.
I don't know. It's better than telling the what boy Arian's book already. You think our blog needs proofreading?
Really? Is there mistakes in there?
There's some evidently some he got some wrong players on the team and some wrong years types of things.
Really?
Yeah,
What?
I think he drinks too much paint.
I did see about that. Yeah, that well, he got name. I don't want to get too sidetracked. He got names wrong though.
Yeah, go read Ray Fittipaldi,
Fittipaldi?
of the PPG had another kind of passage or two that Arians had Burris on a team in the wrong situation or whatnot. I think there as well too. I've got that coming via Amazon, but I don't know when I'm going to be able to get to be able to read it. I love Arians. I always have.
Sure.
You know, and you know, as far as when it comes to offensive coordinators that have no fear about stretching the football field, he's definitely in that boat. Now, was he dangerous to Ben Roethlisberger during the time when they really didn't have much of a line? Yeah, but I think he's an entertaining guy. I think he still doesn't get the credit that he deserves as an offensive coordinator and play caller. But this guy has developed some great quarterbacks as well too during his time. So I look forward to reading that. But yeah, go find a couple of days ago the one that Ray put up in the PPG. But back to what we're talking about with quarterbacks here, kind of close this thing out in a hurry. Joshua Dobbs. I mean, I don't know where. I mean, look, I'm excited about as most to see him during the preseason here because I think he did. I broke him down every six ways from the side. I know more about Dobbs than probably most people listening to this podcast at this point because and I couldn't say that immediately after you know the Steelers drafted him. But I mean, I looked at him in situations in third down situations. I looked at all of his interceptions. I looked at a lot of things that he did good. I think he is a guy that can deliver the deep ball for you as well too, and I think that's a very, very important in the NFL. I think the accuracy at times not there all the way around. I think more than anything, some of his shorter distances and decisions. I'm talking about running back dump offs and things along those. Nate, along those, I think he's the type of guy that too needs to think about living to play for another day. A very athletic quarterback. He's going to present, if we ever get to the point where he's in a game, he's going to present problems for teams that have seven guys in the box, with him willing to take off and move out with it. Now, on top of it, I think I pointed out several times in his favor that his receivers at Tennessee did not help him out a lot. With that said, on a few of those drops, the balls were behind receivers. They were catchable, but behind. So him getting caught up to the speed and quality of the NFL, which, the same can be said for any quarterback coming in, is going to be the biggest, I think, adjustment. I think he's got the tangibles there to be a backup quarterback, a slightly better version or higher quality quarterback than Landry Jones. He obviously has the football IQ and probably able to read some of that stuff a lot better than Landry did. Because look, Landry was what? Just a spread quarterback coming out. A lot of easy throws for Landry coming out of Oklahoma. So I think he's already light years ahead of Landry, when it comes to all that. Now the question becomes, and I don't think we're going to find out in 2017, is just how high of ceiling Joshua Dobbs has.
Sure. No, I agree across the board. It's about consistency for Dobbs. That's step one, just snap to snap, clean exchanges, good progressions, getting the ball out on time. That's just what you want to see with him so far.
Anything look, you'll be charting a lot of Dobbs throws during training camp, So, anything that you think needs to be watched more so than anything else?
I for a rookie like that, I don't really go in with one specific thing because I don't want to start seeing what I want to see or start missing anything else. I just want to go in with a clean slate, and I just want to see that snap to snap consistency though of him, not getting too high on one snap and then having a bad play on the next. I mean, bad plays are going to happen, but you want to rebound from that. You don't want to stack bad plays, and you want to just be, generally an even, steady kind of guy, and that's what a quarterback has to do. So I don't come in with one thing. It's just kind of a whole body of work I want to check out.
Any thoughts on Bart Houston?
Hey, good for him. He made it. They cut Schuessler out of camp, and they signed Houston. I mean, his Wisconsin tape, Houston's was not particularly strong. I think he was benched for a good chunk of his senior year. Came back, I think, for the game against Penn State. He'll get to the table scraps, but we'll see what he can do.
Will he make it to the first preseason game?
Yeah, I think he will. They don't usually cut the fourth quarterback. They hold on to them, the whole way through, it feels like. Brendan Kay, remember him a couple of years ago, coming in late just because they need someone for the fourth game. I think he makes it.
I get through maybe the first week of training camp. I get to that first preseason game. I'm not playing Houston. I'm getting Dobbs out there as much as I can. Look, Landry's not going to have to play the amount of snaps that he's played in previous preseasons. You need to get him his work, however. But I want to see Dobbs push that Landry Jones snap number from a couple years ago. But I don't think we're there yet. I think next year. I think next year during the preseason could actually be the 240 snap, whatever it was, with Jones type of preseason. So, look, I don't care about, if we see Houston, then Houston, we have a problem kind of thing during the preseason there. All right, anything else you'd like to add about the quarterback position or anything else that we've talked to or need to talk to before getting out of here?
Some fan is already blaming Tomlin for the Bryant-Benn comments, so offseason cannot end quickly enough.
Yeah, I believe we had one or a couple last week in some comments blaming Tomlin for Artie Burns not paying all of his fines or whatnot and driving on a suspended license. Look, folks, these are grown men we're dealing with. They're or supposed to be grown men. So unreal. Don't even go there. All right, for 2 weeks to go, before the start of training camp, we had a lot to talk about today. So I think overall, a fairly good show. Alex, I appreciate you sitting in for David Todd once again. Folks, you can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. You can follow David Todd on Twitter at David M. Todd. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Follow Alex Kozora at Alex_Kozora. We're going to be putting up a pledge drive, if you will, for training camp, I'm sure, in the next few days here. If you have some nickels underneath your cushion that you want to donate, fine. If not, we're still going regardless. This is just help us kind of absorb some of the costs associated with this and make sure Alex Kozora eats better than McChicken sandwiches as well too. But Alex, good job once again. Folks, if you want to donate to the cause in general, go to SteelersDepot.com, hit that donate button, upper right navigational bar. If you want to send us an email, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. And as always, thanks for listening to The Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.